This is The Health Show, a presentation of National Productions.
The bombing of the Boston Marathon has a lot of people asking questions. Questions like why, like who was involved, like is the danger over? We're asking questions too. Questions about the people injured in the bombing and what their lives will be like going forward.
They're young people and you know that you're going to make a huge impact on their lives.
On today's Health Show, we'll talk to a doctor who served in Iraq about the traumatic injuries, treatment, and future of the people injured in the attack.
We'll also hear about a soldier who returned from war with injuries and how he dealt with those and with PTSD. Plus, we'll hear from a public health nurse who works in a rundown urban area but refuses to give in to fear. I'm Dr. Nina Sachs.
I'm Bob Barrett, and this is The Health Show. From the moment the first bomb exploded at the Boston Marathon, hundreds of lives were changed forever. Of course, there are the families and loved ones of the people who were killed in the blasts. Then there are the people who were injured, some who literally had limbs ripped from their bodies. To find out about the immediate treatment and care of these people, we turned to someone who worked in similar conditions. Dr. Jason Cohen is a critical care and emergency physician at Albany Medical Center Hospital here in Albany, New York. While he was not in Boston the day of the bombing and has not seen any of those patients, Dr. Cohen served as a medic during the Iraq War and saw people with the same type of savage injuries that doctors were dealing with in the aftermath of the bombing. I asked him about what would be happening in the moments after that attack.
The ones who lost limbs initially would have immediately tried to have their blood loss stopped by application of tourniquets, which is really something relatively new in the civilian side, but we've been using in the military for since the start of the war in Iraq and Afghanistan. They would have been brought essentially to the emergency department and triaged immediately to go to the operating room to go have some more definitive control of the bleeding initially. Oftentimes, if it's just the lower limbs, that would require emergent amputations, and then subsequent to that would probably have multiple other surgeries to go back and to take a second look and to make sure that no injuries were missed and that any dirt or contamination had been removed. And through the course of the subsequent days to weeks, coming to a definitive closure of those wounds.
For something like this, such an awful trauma, there's really no saving of those limbs, are there?
Well, it truly depends. Every patient is different, and unfortunately, there's a lot of chance and randomness that goes into how those injury patterns progress. Once a decision is made to amputate that limb, and that's, I'm not a surgeon myself, but I've been involved in those decisions. It's a gut-wrenching decision for sure, because most of the people that were injured, at least from what I'm understanding there, and based on my experience in the military as well, they're young people, and you know that you're going to make a huge impact on their lives, and it's a hard decision. So you really try everything you can to save those limbs, but when you have to do it to save their lives, you have to do it.
Plus, you're also dealing with a patient who is in severe shock at that time, I'd imagine.
Absolutely. You're really, that initial surgery coming in from the field is what we call damage control, where you're just trying to stop the bleeding and remove the gross contamination as best you can. And then to bring them back into the ICU or onto the floor, resuscitate them, warm them up, get their blood pressure, their bleeding under control, make sure they've been transfused what they need to be. And then once they're a little bit more stable, that's when you would come back for that second surgery.
Unfortunately, we seem to have learned an awful lot about treating accident victims and victims like this from our involvement in the wars. Have we come far over the past 10 years because of that?
I think we have. As I mentioned before, I think the tourniquets have, something that's so simple and really is now getting a lot of attention again. It's saved countless lives in the military, and really something 20 years ago, back when I was initially the EMT and all of that, it was kind of frowned on to use those tourniquets as almost a last resort. Now we're looking at them as a first resort to save lives. And that's the experience in the combat zone, especially with the improvised explosive devices that our soldiers and Marines are seeing. Really, we found those tourniquets are saving lives. So that's changed that initial mentality. And coming from there, also the concept of that damage control, that just going and stopping the bleeding, understanding you're not going to definitively repair on that initial surgery, but really just saving the life and then recognizing you could come back 24 hours later, 36 hours later, and take that second look and do some more definitive surgery.
If it's a choice between life and limb, everybody's going to choose life. Yeah,
clearly.
Obviously, you were not at the scene there, but you have experience. What's going through the minds of the emergency personnel at that time when so many injuries come in?
So I have a very good friend of mine, actually, who was in the medical tent at the finish line at Boston Marathon. She was volunteering there as a physician. She called me the subsequent day and was very shaken up and went through her emotional experience and thinking that I could relate to her experience having been under something kind of similar. And what's going through your mind right then, initially, it's state of shock, the sound, the feeling of the blast, the smell, people screaming, that's shock. But I can tell you from her perspective, she immediately focused into her training, and it comes to that question, just stopping the bleeding and focusing on saving as many lives as you can. Triage really comes into play there, and recognizing when there's somebody who's not going to be safe no matter what you do, and not putting resource on there and spending time on the patients that you can do the most good for. But it's that first few minutes, that assault of really all of your senses from the blast and then the influx of patients and blood and trauma in front of you, it takes a minute for you to kind of focus back on what your job is and to take care of who's in front of you. But while you're taking care of the patients, you're focused on that. And then when the chaos calms down a little bit, that's when you start to reflect on really what you've just been through.
We'll talk about gut-wrenching decisions, deciding having to, stop working on them because you could probably save the other one.
Exactly.
And you talked a lot about the stopping the blood, and we saw so many pictures from the scene where there's just so much blood on the street. How much of a problem is infection after the fact? Because, I mean, you have people out there just right out in the open with open wounds.
Sure. Infection of the patients who are involved with the blast themselves, it can be a major problem because not only do you have the major shrapnel pieces that go and cause the injury, but it causes microscopic particles and bacteria, and that can embed deep into the tissue. And you do everything you can, obviously, during the surgery and then the subsequent surgeries to make sure that you remove any kind of tissue that looks even remotely infected or is threatened at all. But as we're seeing with some of our wounded soldiers and Marines, their infections are coming out weeks after that initial surgery that, despite the most aggressive wound care and decontamination, there's deep seeding of some of the tissue that's hard to control for. But infection is a huge problem, and really you'll start to see the complications of that probably around this time in terms of those patients who were initially injured. You'll start seeing less from the initial trauma, but now the complications of everything that went along with their resuscitation.
Well, what's in store for these patients? I mean, we have so much technology now with artificial limbs, but I mean, you can replace the limb, but that experience is just always going to be there.
Oh gosh, yeah, it's hard to tell you what each one of those people are going to go through. It's a terrifying experience that I can only imagine. I've taken care of them, but I've never been injured in that kind of a situation.
And you expect it in a war zone. You don't expect it at the Boston Marathon.
Exactly, exactly. And it changes a lot. And I'm sure that there was some traumatic brain injury associated with the blast as well, which is going to make some recovery hard for some people as well in terms of concussions and intracranial bleeding. But the psychological impact of this kind of trauma by itself, let alone losing a limb in somebody who's relatively young and vibrant, I can't imagine what that will mean for those people. And it takes a lot of rehab, both physical and probably just as importantly, emotional and psychological rehab for people to start to move on from there.
Dr. Jason Cohen is a critical care and emergency physician at Albany Medical Center Hospital in Albany, New York.
There has been a lot of talk about the possibility of people at the Boston Marathon feeling the effect of post-traumatic stress disorder in the weeks or months after the attack. Again, to get perspective on PTSD, we go to someone who went to war. Sergeant Matthew Pennington was injured while serving on combat duty in Iraq. He showed signs of PTSD, but is working towards recovery by promoting self-identification of these symptoms for other veterans after his appearance in a short fictional film about an Iraq war vet. Damian Biniak from the Salt Institute for Documentary Studies has a report.
When Sergeant Matthew Pennington signed up for his third tour of duty in the Army, he wanted a more active combat role. He signed up to be a machine gunner, riding atop a Humvee as an escort for military convoys headed up and down the eastern side of Iraq.
Like being in Mad Max, it was, you know, you on the open highway, sitting behind a gun, cruising down the road.
As combat increased, he soon found that it wasn't so much like the movies after all. In April of 2006, Matthew was asked to drive the lead vehicle of a convoy headed south towards Balad. As he prepped his gear for the trip, he tucked his tourniquet into his uniform.
It was just like an eerie feeling just kind of fell on that night. You know, it was just something didn't seem right.
Halfway through the drive, the headlights in Matthew's Humvee shorted out, and he was left with a single left-side low-beam light. He was driving at about 50 miles per hour when he spotted a small, homemade bomb in the dim light ahead. But the road was too narrow, and there was no way to get around it.
So there's, you know, no escape.
Matthew stepped on the gas, trying to put as much of the engine's solid mass over the blast as possible.
After the explosion, I tried to hit the brakes, and I felt that I didn't have anything down there and stuff.
Some shrapnel had torn through the floorboards of the Humvee, shattering his right leg and amputating his left leg just above the foot. Not wanting to look at the wound, he reached for his tourniquet and tied off his left leg. Matthew received emergency care and was eventually transported to Walter Reed Army Medical Hospital in Washington, D.C. Not only did they treat his battle wounds, but they also diagnosed him with post-traumatic stress disorder.
Before I got hurt, we'd already been through three or four bombs. We'd been shot at by snipers, you know, we'd been in firefights. So it was by that point, it was just kind of like, you start really thinking about how many times, you know, came near close to death, then, you know, it's like, it'll really weigh on your mind.
When he returned home to the state of Maine, Matthew found it difficult to settle back into civilian life. As he drove the roads around his home, he was looking for roadside bombs and tripwires along the road. He couldn't go to the grocery store or crowded places without feeling anxious. He also found himself to be easily irritated and untrusting of strangers. He was constantly on edge.
You'll have things that'll trigger you, remind you, you know, it's all of a sudden a car commercial comes on and he's flying through the desert. And then you're like, oh, desert. Oh, wait, Iraq. Oh, man, now I'm thinking about it. And then it's like, okay, wait. And then it's just, so you're constantly stressing about things. And that's a lot of the disorder is.
Matthew had a lot of social interaction at Walter Reed, taking marketing classes and going to many things they put together for the soldiers being treated there. At home in Maine, however, he was far removed from the local Veterans Affairs office. They were frequently behind on his paperwork, which complicated getting full coverage for his benefits and attentive treatment.
I don't understand how they expect somebody going through that to be proactive in taking care of their own self when clearly they've got PTSD and they're not doing that.
Even when his paperwork was sorted out, the care they were giving him wasn't helping him. He was still depressed and stressed out. Matthew needed to find another way. In 2009, he learned about a casting call for a short film about an Iraq war vet. Director Nicholas Brennan had interviewed other war veterans and wrote a short fictional account of a Marine returning home to a small Maine town and coming to terms with his own PTSD. I spoke to him by phone.
We had to find a young male who was an amputee, who was a veteran, who was ideally from New England, or, you know, it'd be great if he's from Maine, you know, who can act.
Although Matthew had never acted before, the director knew he was a good fit.
It was pretty clear as soon as we really started going that there was a lot there with Matthew and that he was sort of looking for an outlet for himself.
In this scene from A Marine's Guide to Fishing, Matthew's character has a PTSD episode while he's attempting to fix a boat engine. He's approached by an imaginary superior officer.
Damn it, Lance Corporal! What the hell are you trying to pull?
All due respect, Staff Sergeant. Doing the best I can. This could take a while.
A while?
I never expected to like film. I never expected to really care for the arts or even really, you know, think about it. I loved drawing growing up. I loved playing music. But, you know, that was really about where it went to. So I figured, you know, well, I got PTSD and this is a horrible place for me to go, you know, so let's go do it. Let's get through this.
The experience was better than therapy. In playing the part of the fictional Connor Sullivan, Matthew saw parallels with his own life and came to his own realizations about his PTSD.
The part I most identified with was when he was fishing and he was having intrusive thoughts, because that was a problem I'd have a lot, as I would be going about my normal day and then all of a sudden I'm thinking about this thing in Iraq.
Matthew has since begun touring with the film, presenting lectures for other veterans who have had a chance to watch the project. He wants to bring it to other former soldiers suffering from trauma and PTSD as a way of communicating with them. He hopes that vets in a similar situation can self-identify some internal issues they may not have otherwise seen within themselves, like he did.
That's kind of, I think, one of the best approaches to take is kind of why we do it. You know, it's better than confronting them or, you know, trying to shove it down their throat. If they can see it, realize it within themselves, you know, they're much more likely to succeed.
Matthew found a way to move forward through this film project, but for him, the camera wasn't the cure. It was what was in front of the lens that could really fix him. By accepting how he had changed, he was able to move forward in healing his issues with PTSD. For Salt Radio, I'm Damian Bignac.
Still to come, a public health nurse in an inner-city neighborhood deals with the day-to-day fears of her job. That's next on The Health Show.
You can find The Health Show anytime online at healthshow.org. Search the archive and listen to whole programs you may have missed or would like to hear again. Even subscribe to our podcast. That's healthshow.org. You can also follow us on Facebook. Just go to facebook.com/thehealthshow.
You can start your own Health Show archive with a CD copy of the program. Call toll-free 800-323-9262. Be sure to ask for Health Show number 1308.
This is The Health Show. I'm Bob Barrett.
And I'm Dr. Nina Sachs. Amy Gastelum is a public health nurse making daily home visits to areas of Brooklyn where crime is common. Some of Amy's friends and family worry about her safety as she uses public transportation and shoe leather to travel between clients. But Amy has discovered that there is a price to pay for fear.
Have a good day. Every day I leave my apartment in a part of Queens where nobody worries about me getting hurt.
Hi, good morning.
A lot of people who take the G train south to Brooklyn get off at stops that connect to Manhattan. There aren't a lot of people who get off the train at my stop. There are no connections to the city here. It's Bed-Stuy, the heart of Brooklyn. This is where some people worry about me. I make visits to people's homes in this neighborhood. I'm a public health nurse for low-income first-time moms. I go to places that a lot of my friends and family will never go, ever. For some of them, that means certain blocks of Bed-Stuy. For others, it means stepping into a tiny stainless steel elevator wet with urine in a public housing complex. I just can't see my father-in-law there, and he can't either. So when we talk about my job, he fixates on safety. Pat has encouraged me to carry a taser, and my mother-in-law wants me to carry bear spray, which is mace. Enough for a bear.
Morning.
A few people want me in self-defense classes. I'm told to keep my face up and look around. Don't look down and distract it. Don't stand next to vans. Someone could open the door and snatch me. Don't wear overalls because someone could cut the straps with a knife. Don't wear my hair in a ponytail. Someone could grab it and control me that way. But my favorite advice is this. If I need to get on an elevator and there's a creepy person there too, fake a conversation on my flip phone. Oh, hi. Yeah, this is Amy. Okay, then hold up a finger and tell the creepy person, oh, go on up. It's my boss on the phone. Like they care who it is. A lot of the other nurses do this. But I think if I tried it, I would laugh at myself and they would think, I was creepy, making fake phone calls and laughing. To be fair, all the advice I'm given is not completely baseless. There have been attacks on visiting nurses. In 2010, Carrie Lynn Johnson was caring for a patient in Detroit when someone entered the house, shot her and her patient, and set the house on fire. Then there was the home visiting nurse in New Orleans who was kidnapped and raped by 5 men last year while working. One nurse at my job was walking on the street and got punched in the face for her iPhone. She always finishes the story saying she shouldn't have brought it out. She has to say that, or someone else will. I know that if I embrace fear and I'm attacked, people will say it wasn't her fault. She was very cautious. But if I don't show the right amount of fear and I'm attacked, people will say I was careless and I will have to take some of the blame. It's not that I'm fearless. I'm not from this city and I'm pretty small. I have my own fear I carry, but the consensus seems to be that it's not enough. I jokingly told a friend that my plan for the guys who started to follow me one day was to tell them I'm an undercover cop. I laughed at myself. She didn't smile. She said, "Amy, you may think you have a plan, but those guys stood there all day thinking of a plan for you." Made it. I feel powerless and exhausted when people remind me to be afraid. You know, walking into a patient's life saying, "I'm going to take care of you," without being 100% sure if you're safe is something that nurses have always done. But usually the risk is infection. The nurses that took care of HIV-positive patients in the 1980s must have been afraid. And maybe their friends and family couldn't understand why they would want to keep doing that work. But their friends and families never got to see their human patients being human beings.
Hello.
I can't stop someone from hurting me if they really want to. But fear makes me give up on friendliness with the people who also walk in the neighborhood. Fear messes up my ability to see my client as a unique individual if I'm scared of her environment or her family. I give up on ponytails and overalls. I give up on daydreams like gifts that wander in while I walk between visits. Fear requires my whole brain. I would rather take the blame.
Amy Gastelum is a public health nurse in New York City. She also produced this segment, which she called Rather Take the Blame. That's all the time we have for this week's Health Show. If you'd like to listen again, join us online at healthshow.org. You can explore the archive for any programs you might have missed or would like to hear again. You can also subscribe to our podcast. That's healthshow.org.
Want more? Then follow us on Facebook. Just go to facebook.com/thehealthshow. And if you have any questions or comments about the program, send them in. Our email address is letters@healthshow.org.
I'm Bob Barrett.
And I'm Dr. Nina Sachs.
Stay healthy and be sure to join us next time for another edition of The Health Show.
Dr. Nina Sachs is a practicing member of the American College of Gastroenterology. Bob Barrett is producer of The Health Show. Dr. Alan Chartok is executive producer. The Health Show is a presentation of National Productions, which is solely responsible for its content.